Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm continuing to talk about the myths that we believe about change, about what makes change possible, what one has to do to change, and how believing these myths gets in the way of the changes that we want to make. I'm also playing an interview that I did with Chris Musgrave, the quintessential music man. If it has anything to do with music, if there's any way to use music or anything that anybody is doing with music, Christopher has done it. I know that you'll find this interview really interesting. So, hang in. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive.
Welcome to The Lynn Show. As I said in the opening that preceded the opening song, today I'm going to talk about another myth. I've been talking about the myths that we believe about change, about what makes change happen, about how you change, about what you have to do to change, about what's possible as it regards change. These are ideas that we hold that we're not really conscious of holding. They're so much a part of the culture that we don't question them, but I believe they are not true. And if you believe that something is true, if you believe that if you do thus and such, then you will be able to change, and that's not true, then if you do thus and such and you don't change, what are you going to feel? Well, of course, you're going to feel bad, especially if you believe that doing thus and such should have worked. Maybe doing thus and such worked for somebody else, everybody else. Then you're going to feel that there's something wrong with you, and your self-esteem will be lowered. Now, one of the things that I do believe about change is that when we're going to make a difficult change, the level of our self-esteem is very important to our success. The higher your self-esteem, the better you feel about yourself, the more competent you feel, the better chance you have. Now again, that's not all that matters. There are many, many other variables that influence our ability to change, but the level of our self-esteem is one of them. So if you believe that thus and such is going to make it happen for you, and you do thus and such with your whole heart, and it doesn't happen for you, the chances are good you are going to have lowered self-esteem and be less able to do what you want to do. So the more you know about what is really true about change and what is a myth, the less you're going to fall into those pitfalls. the myth I want to talk about today has to do with how we feel about how we can change ourselves. We seem to believe in this culture that we ought to be able to change what we think, what we feel, how we act, who we are, just because we've decided we don't like that. So if you you say, "Oh, I'm not really spiritual, and I really want to be," or "I'm not courageous, I can't take risks. I see other people being risk takers, and I value that, and I think that's really important, and I want to be a risk taker," or "I'm so shy, and it gets in my way, and it undermines me, and I really don't want to be shy anymore." We seem to have the idea that because we've decided this thing about ourselves is not what we want it to be, or there is something else that we want to be, that we ought to be able to say, "Okay, I don't want to be that anymore," and it should go away. Well, clearly that's not true. I mean, anybody who has tried that knows it is not true. It doesn't mean that one cannot change who one is, what one believes, but one can't do it simply because one has said one wants to. I'm thinking about a client, my very first client, actually. When she came to see me, she said, "What I need help with is I want to be an actress." And I said to her, "Well, I will be very happy to help you figure out what it is you want. But if you don't want to be an actress, I don't think I can help you manufacture that want. But again, this is a myth. I ought to be able to make myself want whatever I want to want." It is my belief, and I've talked about this in earlier shows, that we often accuse ourselves of being self-destructive or sabotaging. And I don't believe that human beings are self-destructive. That was almost a Freudian slip, because what I do believe is that we are self-protective. We don't sabotage. Even when we're doing behaviors that seem to be causing us distress, even pain, those behaviors are designed to protect us from a greater pain or distress. That's what I believe. And that knowing the greater context, knowing what it is that this behavior, whatever it is designed to protect you from, is the beginning of being able to change it. Today, I talked to a young woman who is distressed by the fact that all of the intimate relationships she's had have been with men who are, by her definition, emotionally unavailable. They are not warm and fuzzy. They do not know how to comfort. They are not there when she's in pain. She doesn't want to have that kind of relationship. She wants to have the kind of relationship she had with her dad. Her dad was warm and fuzzy and terrifically affectionate and emotionally available to her. Unfortunately, her father died when she was quite young. What she's been doing all these years is protecting herself from that terrible loss. If she found another emotionally available, warm and fuzzy guy, and she lost him, re-experiencing that would be too terrible. So her unconscious chose to protect her by not ever getting her in a relationship where she could feel that need and be that vulnerable. Now that she knows that, we can begin to work on developing skills for her to tolerate loss. Because until she can tolerate loss, she can't risk the kind of relationship she wants. But it's understanding why she was doing this other behavior, this behavior that seemed to be the opposite of what she wanted, that makes it possible for her to begin to do the work that will lead to the change. simply saying, next time I'm going to choose a warm and fuzzy guy. Well, it didn't work. And it wasn't going to work because the greater part of her was protecting her. And by the way, my first client actually wanted to be a singer, and she is. In another show, I will tell you how we worked on that for her. So, are you thinking about something that you want to do differently, be differently, think differently, believe differently, act differently? Are you willing to consider that there's a really good reason, that there's a self-protective reason that you are doing what you're doing or not doing what you're not doing? And maybe this is a good time for a commercial. If you've been listening, you know that I wrote a book called When You Can, You Will. And there's a workbook attached, well, separate, actually. The workbook is designed to help you figure out what it is that's getting between you and what it is you want to do or stop doing and what you might do about it. So if you're interested in the book or the workbook, you can go up on my website, thelynnshow.com, thelynnshow, and click on Contact Me, and I will let you know how to get it. I've been saying that we can't arbitrarily change. But sometimes things happen that change us. Things that are out of our control that we hadn't intended may not even have seen coming. And the interview that I'm doing today with Chris Musgrave is an example of that. Chris was, at 33, a very successful record producer, recording engineer, had his own studio, his home with his wife and his 5-year-old daughter and his really unique pets. He was a happy man. He was doing what he wanted to do when he had a massive heart attack and many bypasses. And they wiped him out, not only physically and emotionally, but financially. His whole life shifted on that day. And he changed. Now, in Chris's case, I didn't know him before. I suspect that the change is that he became more of who he was. And he talks about that in this interview, what that experience meant to him and how it altered the way he sees life, what he believes about life, and how he lives his life. Chris is a music man. He's also, in my view, a Renaissance man. He holds very, very strong opinions, which he expresses with no second thoughts. He's dramatic and dynamic and really interesting. And I know that you're going to find him compelling and thought-provoking and maybe occasionally a little offensive, but hang in. This interview is so well worth it. So here now is Chris Musgrave. Okay, so I'm here in room 136 of the Best Western in downtown Sarasota with Chris Musgrave.
How you doing?
I'm doing okay, Christopher.
You're always doing okay.
Well, I don't know about that. And Chris has just come, as he said, off a 30-hour day.
Yeah.
So,
very long day.
A very long day. So he has graciously agreed to talk to me for as long as he can stay up. Or I can stay up, because it's very late for
this
me.
This becomes my hour now.
Yes, so that's right. We're in your time,
that's right?
Right? That's right. This is Chris' time, right?
This is when I start.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, but yeah.
Well, and pretty much you haven't stopped very much for today, so.
Yeah, no.
Okay, so, Christopher, I know you now. How long do I know you now?
Several years.
Well, at least. It was
more than that.
Yeah.
Actually, you still, 6 years.
When did you close the studio?
At least 5 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah,
at
so
least
it's more than
ago.
That.
Yeah. Because it was at my first heart attack.
Right after.
Right.
Right.
Which was 7 years ago.
Right. So it was right after that.
Yeah, so 7 years.
Wow. No kidding.
7 years, yeah.
So I met Chris because I needed to have a reel-to-reel tape transferred to CD.
I remember that.
I'm glad, yeah. And it was what, 2-inch tape, 1-inch tape?
It was a half-inch, reel-to-reel.
Yeah. And there's nobody.
It was a nightmare.
Yeah, well, there's nobody in the world who has a machine that could even play that.
No, I had the machine.
But you had the machine.
Yeah.
And so I came to the studio, and you said to me, I can tell by the box that tape is older than I am.
Yep.
And you were close.
Yeah. But we were able to save it.
Yes, we actually
as best
were.
We could, yeah.
Yeah, and
a lot of splicing.
I have songs that I would not have because of that. So I do this interview series called Anatomy of an Artist.
It's intriguing.
Yes. I thought it was.
Intriguing.
I'm not sure
you want to learn too much about some artists.
Well, so far so good. But we could be altering that now. So what I mostly have been asking people is how they found or were captured by or discovered.
Wrong place at the wrong time.
What do you mean?
That's how I got into this. Wrong place at the wrong time.
Well, one of the things I was thinking about when I was coming over here is I wouldn't even begin to know how to define you. You know, I mean, most people I can say...
You mean
say,
what I do or
yeah,
me?
Well, what you, I'm not going to try the you. No, what you consider to be your art.
You know what I guess mine would be? Manipulation.
No.
Yeah, and I'll tell you why.
Okay.
My job is basically to manipulate whatever time and space I'm at to do the best for the situation, whether it be the artist I'm with or the problem the tour has. I need to manipulate that time to have it go either smooth their way or whatever it's going to be. Either as a tour manager or a producer, it doesn't matter. It's still the same theory.
You're
still manipulating something.
Yes.
So it's basically a job of constant manipulation, whether that be psychologically, financially.
Okay, but you do that in the arena of music.
Yeah. I mean, well, people do it to an extent in every part of their day.
Yeah, but you do it. I mean, this is...
I do it specifically.
Yes. Right.
And with forethought and malice.
You don't want to put that on the website, right?
You have to, though, in some cases. You know, that's what a client pays you to do.
Malice to others, not them.
Well, of course. But yes. not so much to somebody's physical, you know, being, of course, but definitely to the situation. You know, I mean, it's what do you pay an attorney to do? Paying him to manipulate something with forethought and malice in your favor.
That's right.
So.
Okay, but but what I want to know is, if you can, well, a lot of things. I want to know a lot of things. I mean, where the music came into it.
Where the music came into my working with it or where I became interested in music?
Yeah, you.
From the time I was born.
Yeah, tell me about
that. I mean, I was
that.
Raised in a house. My father is an internationally known artist and a professor of art. Never didn't have music playing. And it was always, I mean, I grew up with the Allman Brothers, which was a weird, obviously, coming up. And ended up working with Dickie Betts.
What do you mean you grew up listening to them?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. There was never a time in my house that music didn't play.
And they played the Allman Brothers?
Oh, yeah. Sure.
Among other things.
Oh, yeah. A lot of classic blues. B.B. King, Blind Willie McTell, Robert Johnson, you know what I mean? And you just keep going through all that to the Allman Brothers, to the Eagles, there was never. And then on my mother's side, or, you know, what she was listening to was a lot of classical, German classical, or German opera. But no matter what, in the house there was music playing.
Okay, so... did you think I want to do this with my life, or...
Never.
Okay, so how did that happen then?
Again, wrong place at the wrong time.
Well,
I say that because I don't recommend this industry to anybody.
Yeah, I got it.
It's not healthy. You have to be a specific person. Your career is short-lived.
There's
it's not what everybody thinks it is. It started, I guess, in high school, that there were a lot of local bands, and I never really wanted to be the rock star. I didn't get that.
No.
No, I thought it was pretty, I mean, besides the obvious of vain, but that's not how a teenager thinks in terms of something being vain. I thought it was, I thought you had to have a weak mind.
Really?
Yeah.
Because
you needed that exposure and you needed that applause, and to me that was, if you can't get through the day without that, then...
Not good.
No, I think that's pretty weak.
Wow.
And I still, you know, to a sense, think some of that today with some of these guys out there. And yet some of them I've gotten to know, some really, really big ones. Axl Rose would always be a great example of actually a very, very strong mind, very intelligent human being.
There have to be some.
Yeah, but then it goes even past that. There has to be problems with these people.
What do you
there
mean?
There has to be. You can't be a rock star or a very well-known public figure without being a certain persona. You have to be a little screwed up, you know, is the only way to say it, to even be that person.
You're saying because that's what it takes?
Yeah, it's what it takes to be that person, to walk out on stage in front of 20,000 people.
Yeah.
And pour out whatever you think your heart is, or whatever it is you think your art is, for that matter. You've got to be a little touched.
Okay.
You know, just to live this life.
Okay, so, well, to live your life.
Well, too. Yeah, no, I'm talking about within this industry.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, this is not something for the faint-hearted or, you know, somebody who can't stomach things or their time is, you know, I work from 9 to 5 and, you know, eat dinner at 6 and go to bed around 9:30, 10 after, you know, Leno or something. That doesn't work.
No. Okay, so go back with me.
Okay, so we'll go back to high school.
Right.
A lot of bands there. And I started seeing that I was more interested in the audio side of things.
Mm-hmm.
So, a lot of people who live near us. Brian Wilson from the Beach Boys, Brian May from Queen. You know, there's a lot of the Eagles, Don Felder. These were all neighbors of ours.
Wow.
So, I actually, as a young kid, got to go a lot of places, a lot of studios. Checked a lot of things out and was basically, didn't care. Too young to, again, understand or, you know, it's weird question to answer because at that age, you're not thinking what you want to do.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? In high school, you're not trying to figure out what you're going to be. And, you know, the kids that I did find at 18 years old that were trying to figure out what they were going to major in college and what they were going to be for the rest of their life were, again, weak people. You know what I mean?
So you were coasting?
No. I was exploring.
Ah, yes. I got it. Okay.
I don't call it coasting.
No.
Coasting is somebody that just sat around, got high, and didn't do anything.
Yeah, no. Well, that would never be you.
Me, I would know. Got to go.
No,
gotta go
I know.
See something. Experience something.
Yes.
But, yeah, just that whole I'm going to do this and I'm going to be that and have the next 30 years planned out, I couldn't do that now.
No, I know. Never mind the next 30 years,
right,
the next 30
next
minutes.
30 minutes right. No, it was all about the stimulus to me.
Yes.
And music did that. And it took a while, and I left it for a while and went and did nothing when exploring. Took off to Australia, took off to Seattle, did this, did that. Built a couple car stereo shops. It was audio still. It was still
yeah.
Music. I've constantly always enjoyed the fact that one way or another I get paid to listen to music.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So it just goes back to the music.
Yeah.
No matter what form I'm in, whether I'm designing a recording studio or I'm building a sound system in a nightclub or I'm rewiring a church or a car stereo. Now, the car stereos I used to do were $20,000-$30,000.
Wow.
You know, I did the ones that would rattle your foundation and of the house and stuff, but it was a large amount of money, and I did it for, you know, some very big people. Christopher Walken's cars were done by me. I've done a couple of Snoop Doggy Dogg's cars. I've done, you know, and these people paid a lot of money for this stuff.
And you got to listen to music while you were doing it.
That's right.
Oh, it's amazing.
And the whole job, same almost as an engineer, though. My job was to make music sound better.
Yes.
You start with a factory car stereo, you don't like the way it sounds. You give me $30,000, I make it sound a lot better. You know what I mean? So, but it's almost the same token as recording.
Yeah.
Your job is to take something and make it sound either better or, you know what I mean? And so it was weird, though, because I had to decide, was it the music or was it the art of audio?
The art of making it better.
Yeah, which, I mean, you start getting into Ohm's laws and frequencies and yada, 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 and I was never the book engineer.
No.
Well, you know, and I was kind of taught not to be, though, because I think the better rule is that as long as it sounds good, it doesn't matter how you did it.
Yeah, how you got there.
Right. So I think the guys are like, no, it has to be 4-to-1 compression, and you can't do that. No, that's just got What do you mean?
But you know all that stuff. You know all those.
But I don't know all the. Well, I mean, a lot of the technical. You know, I could BS my way was probably some of the best.
Right.
You know what
right.
I mean? But at the end of the day, I mean, how does mine sound? I revert back to that. You know, there's a lot of these guys that'll talk all the technical crap they want.
Yeah.
Great. Good for you.
Right. Okay. So now we. So how did you wind up producing and then having a studio? This cannot be the wrong place in the wrong time. I know you're trying.
Sense,
yes. I know you're trying. I know you're trying.
No, in a sense, yes. I produced records in L.A. for high school kids and local bands because nobody else was, and they couldn't afford to, you know, go see Bob Rock or somebody, you know, or a Mutt Lang or, you know, whoever at the time. And so it was easy to pick up. You know, back then it was all about an 8-track. You know, not the player, but an 8-track recorder. We only had 8 tracks.
Right.
So it was like one, possibly 2 microphones for the drums, you know, maybe 1 for the 2 guitars. You only had 8 channels, which...
And where did you do this? And was it
garages.
Like, yeah, that's what...
Wherever the rehearsal space was.
It's amazing. That's where they've gotten back to now, right?
Well, now you think about it, though. You go back to, like, the best, in my opinion, or the two, Tom Dowd or Brian Wilson from Beach Boys. These guys were doing it with 1 microphone.
Wow.
And if you think of those old classics that you listen to still to today, how good they sound, mm-hmm. they were done with 1 microphone.
How did they do that? They put those instruments all over the place?
Well, what happened is, if this is quieter, move this closer.
Oh, wow.
And move that back. Right. And until they had around that microphone and had it surrounded and everything spatially set.
They made the balance... With the
sound, with the attack of the instrument, the attack of the vocal, the closeness, proximity to the microphone.
Right,
and they did it with 1 microphone. And they made some of the best recordings there is. They still hold up.
That's amazing.
And what happened, and the way I was taught, is people, as technology went, and we got all these tracks now, you got these, you know, some consoles with over 100 channels on them.
Right.
You know, some very common ones in big recording studios are 72 channels. So we get to mic every single little nuance.
Right.
And then screw with every single little nuance.
And you know what? It costs a fortune.
Oh, yeah.
Because...
Well, those consoles right there. I mean, you're talking about $2 to $3 million console.
I'm not talking about the console. I'm talking about the editing time.
Oh, yeah. No. Yeah, we're not cheap.
The mixing time.
It's not cheap.
No. Because you've got all this stuff you have to balance.
Oh, balance or manipulate?
Well, okay, fine. Yes.
Do you see what I'm saying, though?
I do.
You're back to manipulating frequencies now and volumes. Well, no. It's a game.
Yeah.
Manipulation to me is a game.
Yeah, I know.
Business is a game.
Yeah.
I mean, that's all business is, manipulation.
I know. Okay, stop now. Go back.
Okay,
you still did not tell me.
So, produced some albums out there and had the 8 channels, and I did it the old way. Where instead of just like, okay, we're going to do this on the drum kit, we're going to do this on the guitars. No. Let's set the mics up or the instruments up and see where it sounds best.
Right.
And I got results. Because I wasn't taking it the literal, this mic is for this.
Right.
And I still don't, you know, to today. So I did a couple, and, you know, it was fine. And I left it again. And where did I go that time? Backpacking through Germany, I think, at that point.
How old are you now?
19.
Okay.
Yeah. Gone.
Gone.
Yeah.
Where's Chris?
Yeah. So then I didn't get back into it again until 10 years ago. No more than that. No. Strike that. 13 years ago is when I got back into it. And it's when I moved to Sarasota is when I got back into music again.
And why did you move to Sarasota?
My wife.
You?
I met her in Malibu, California. But she was from... Sarasota, been her whole life. And after we decided to get married, she said, I want to go home. And I said, where's home? She said, Sarasota. And I said,
what?
Where's that? She goes, an hour south of Tampa. And I said, what's an hour south of Tampa? It's all swampland down there. So, sight unseen, I moved to Sarasota.
Wow.
There was a gentleman here in town that heard that I dabbled with this and did that and dabbled with that and did that and said, what do you want to do? And I said, you know, there's not a single real recording studio in town. And he said, come to my office Monday. And I went to his office Monday, and, you know, he said, you got a business plan? I said, matter of fact, I do, you know, rough sketch of one. And he goes, great, let me look at it. And he literally took it from me and set it down to the side of him and never opened it. Said, how much do you need? He said, well, I don't know, about $300,000.
Oh, my God.
And he called out to his secretary and said, bring me a check.
Wow.
And he handed me a check for about $300,000.
Was he a partner now?
Yeah. Who wanted it to run very corporate. Wanted my employees...
He was looking at you and talking to you, and he wanted it to run very corporate?
Yeah. Intriguing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Which to me, though, means the game was afoot.
Oh. Oh, my God.
So, we did our, you know, payroll and taxes out and yada, right. Yada, blah, blah. And then... series of events within the area and 9/11 and stuff happened and things dropped down and the studio was, you know, not as busy as it should have been and he left the country and left his son-in-law in charge and, you know, after blah, 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 I actually somehow got his son-in-law to sell out to me for 20 cents on the dollar.
Wow.
Which I quickly did.
Yes.
And they were gone and, of course, now the principal partner, when he got home and found this out, wasn't
happy.
Thrilled with his son-in-law.
Wow.
And asked him, how were you talked into 20 cents on the dollar?
How were you manipulated? Right, right,
right. The next time I saw that gentleman, it was a simple, he bought me a drink and said, touche.
Yeah. Oh, very nice.
So.
Great. Okay, good.
He would have done the same thing. And, of course, he was trying to get something out of me.
Yeah.
So.
So, how did you wind up with Dickie?
Dickie found me with Bud Snyder.
Oh. Because Bud was in the studio?
No, Bud at the time was Dickie's tour manager.
But how did Bud find you?
Through the studio.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Came to the studio, and they were looking for a place to record Dickie. And so the game was afoot again. You've met Dickie, so
yeah, yeah.
You know how that can be.
Yeah.
And me and Dickie became real close, and that obviously grew on to me working with him for several years.
Right, right.
Until I resigned... and got paroled for good behavior.
Okay, so I didn't realize it's always about the music, and it's always about manipulating it, and it's always about making something having to do with music better.
Yes and no. When I'm doing the part of career that I enjoy, which is like producing music,
yeah.
Then yes, that is my true passion. Nowadays, as you know, with that state of the music industry, that's a very difficult one to be in.
Yeah.
So I'm stuck also tour managing and doing being a live engineer, which isn't so much of getting to make it better as it is, unfortunately, turned to just manipulation.
Well, just trying to avoid.
Logistics.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
Just, it all comes down to logistics.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm a psychologist, a psychotherapist, I'm a doctor, I'm a nurse, I'm an accountant, I'm a tour agent, travel agent, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do know.
Yeah. All the way across the board. And it's 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
So.
This is a job not a lot of people could do.
It's not healthy.
No.
No.
It's too hard.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a short lifespan.
Short lifespan meaning?
Career time, unless you are just a very salty, seasoned road dog. This is
or
not something...
Or you're very young.
Yeah, well, it's almost worse when you're young. You'd rather have played your games before you get into this, because if you get into this and still are interested in the partying and you're young and without the experience, this can actually be deadly.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
So I don't recommend it for young.
Or even for old.
It's kind of like the old, well, not old idea, the smart idea of trust funds for children. You don't give it to them when they're 18.
Yeah, right.
You let the drinking years go by for a few years, and maybe when they're 25, start doling out the trust fund. And let them get past the games first.
Okay, so here you are, tour managing.
Yeah. Again.
Again, right.
Yeah.
Do you have plans?
No, because that goes into that whole everything's mapped out.
Yeah, right. I forgot.
More importantly, ever since my heart attack, I don't like doing that.
Yeah, I don't blame you.
I really don't. People ask me how old I am, and I tell them that I'm 7. because when I walked out of the hospital that day, everything about me was completely different. My hearing, my vision.
Really?
Yeah.
You never told me that.
Yeah, it was one of the strangest things I ever experienced, actually. And the doctor made it very clear to me. He goes, well, your whole life your arteries have been clogged. So you're not getting anywhere near the blood you've been needing to get. And all of a sudden now it's wide open, so colors were more vibrant, sounds were... It really freaked me out because that was my career. I'm like,
no,
my
kidding.
Hearing's changed.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it really scared the hell out of me.
Yeah.
But no, everything was tenfold. And he said, okay, well, if you... He goes, you own a marine company. I said, yeah, I did. He goes, and you race motorcycles. I said, yep. And he goes, okay, so an engine, you pinch a fuel line, it'll run, but not that well. When you release that fuel line, what happens?
Right, right.
So, and the human body's the same way.
So you had to get used to this.
Yeah. Yeah, it was, I'd never, you know, maybe as a kid, but you don't, you know, recognize those things as a kid, or just like
right.
anything, as if it's a gradual thing.
Yeah,
you
right,
don't
you
get
didn't,
it.
You didn't
no.
notice that it was.
Yeah, this was a, pow, wow, it's really bright out here, and that green is really green, you know, and my wife's going, what are you talking about? I'm like, something's funky, you know, and then all of a sudden this, we were leaving Sarasota Memorial Hospital, and this ambulance went by.
Oh, sound.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I've always covered my ears due to protect my, you know, my income, but this was, like,
oh.
rattling the inside of my skull loud and frequencies as I've never heard them before. So I had to, yeah, relearn.
Wow.
Which was great because it made my hearing better
yeah,
than it
yeah,
was.
Right.
But once you get used to how you pick out a frequency or deal with it, then to have it all amplify or change on you is, yeah, that was weird. So, but at that point, too, I mean, because, I mean, I saw my own flatline on the table.
Yeah.
So I hate to say this because I'm a father, but I stopped caring right there.
Stopped caring.
Stopped caring about, oh, you got to be here at 5 o'clock, or what are you going to do in the next 5 years, and what plan do you have? I stopped caring. Because you know what? I was just like everybody else before that, trying to get ahead and trying to own a house and trying to, you know what? And, yeah, it's a colossal worker ant theory waste of life. So I just don't do it. And it's fly by the seat of my pants, yeah. And still raise a daughter, yep. And however, I'm convinced to raise her with love and show her more experiences. And
yeah, and I don't, you know, when you say you don't care, what I know is that doesn't mean you don't care for her.
Oh, no, of course, I mean, right. No, she's, yeah, that's my best friend, but, no, I don't care about the, what are you going to do, how are you going to plan for the future?
Yeah.
I'm not going to.
Well, you know, my life is very like that, so,
Yeah, but you're incredibly organized.
Well, but only in the minute. Not in the long term.
What are you doing next Tuesday?
I don't know.
Really? Usually you have a trip planned somewhere.
Yeah, a week from Wednesday.
Ah. There you go. I couldn't tell you what's going on after. I know exactly what I'm doing up until, what's today? Today's the 16th?
Yes.
Okay, so I know up through the 19th. And after that, no clue. If I had my way right now, I would be figuring out a way either back to Australia or to Europe for at least 3 weeks.
Well, that's not an impossible dream for you. I mean, it just...
Well,
you know,
if a tour happens to take
right,
me there again,
right.
Yeah, that's one thing. But, see, it's different where when I'm touring, it's I'm going here and I got to do this.
And you can't leave the tour to go do what
no.
you want to do, right?
Yeah, you know, that's where everybody goes. You know, how many countries did you do last year? You know, in the 1 year I did, what, 62 countries or something. I was in Milan, and there's this castle downtown, and it's kind of a museum now. And we went down, we went to the castle, and we're waiting in line, and two American kids had come out, and they go, you guys American? Going, yeah. You going, hey, yeah. Well, here, take our passes. It's like, really? What's this for? And they go, oh, it's for the exhibit. And we didn't even know there's anything going on. And we still didn't with these passes, but said, oh, we're here.
Right.
So we walk in, and this is from the center of this courtyard, which was a graveyard, basically, in the middle of this castle. And we walk in, and it's Da Vinci's private library. To me, one of the most amazing men in the history of the world is Da Vinci. In everything he did.
Right.
It didn't matter. Painting was the least that I'm interested in. That was one of the most amazing things I've ever seen in my life. Looking at what he read. And why he read it and what he had to say about reading it. I mean, look, if everything we've got today, how much of it was designed by him? Whether it be the helicopter, the submarine, the machine gun, or you know, anything else, this was all him. And so you look at his, you know, his drawings and sketches of these things, and it's kind of freakish of how even back then you'd even think about a helicopter.
Right.
You know, why would you?
Why?
But if you look at the rudimentary idea of something, creating motion, because that's something as a child you do. I think every child will tell you they've swung something and heard the noise that it makes, you know, and felt the wind that it makes. Every child has looked at a bird and wished, oh, wow.
Yeah, you know what I mean?
So it starts at, you know, it's a question of how many people retain that.
The wonder and the curiosity and the interest.
They don't. It's a shame that people give in to what society decides your career and life and the way it needs to go.
Well, and if you look around at what's going on now, they all got, or many of them...
They got screwed.
Got screwed.
Yep, they busted their butt for 40 years and just had it all taken away from them.
Exactly.
And so you kind of keep people around you that are either going to stimulate you in some manner or help you grow. And if they can't do that, then you're kind of wasting your time.
Yeah, well, you're not a waste of time.
I have a short tolerance for a lot of things like that, actually.
Especially, no kidding.
Yeah, stupidity and me don't get along well. Yeah, and you know what I've noticed, actually, it's getting worse in me.
Well, they do say that as we get older, everything gets
really, because it's, well, this is getting,
Yeah.
Well, pretty soon I'm going to have to remove myself from society.
Well, this is be hard to do what you're doing now with this.
It is. Might be why Hood River came into play for me.
Ah, because you're so
isolated.
Far away, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
There's not a lot of people there. There's woodsmen there.
Yeah.
That can't read, can't write.
These
are common sense geniuses.
Right.
You know what I mean?
So
you have to weigh that.
Right.
You know, education doesn't mean you're smart. Especially in today's quote-unquote education. You know, as a father now fighting what school my daughter goes to.
Right.
You know, and I've switched her 3 times. And I'll start here in Sarasota, Florida. A very, very, very wealthy community. Well, Mr. Jeb Bush, last time I'll ever use his name, thankfully, took away all the funding for arts and music and all the schools.
Right.
You live here?
Yeah.
You've driven past that giant Pepsi sign over the football field?
No.
Have you ever been on campus to see all the vending machines?
Oh, God, you're kidding.
I find that very intriguing. And I'm also shocked when I saw the budget increase for football, softball, baseball.
Are you serious?
I'm very serious. So
you know that they're getting rid of teachers.
Yes.
Forget art and music.
So here's the deal, though. We can afford new football pads, new jerseys for a sport that injures, maims, and kills brain cells even more so than your body.
Right.
But stuff that is proven over centuries to increase your knowledge, such as music, you know what I mean? Your mathematical skills and the way you approach things, if you understand music, is tenfold gone. And this shows the absolute, I'll say it, stupidity based upon the people that think they know how to run or govern.
Right.
And they have no business. None.
Well,
if these are the decisions they make, I don't want anything to do with them. So, and then I started noticing that this also follows the principles. And it also follows the chain of money where when I moved to Hood River, without getting into it, there's this area of high plains and there's area of farmers and kind of in townish.
Mm-hmm.
First school my daughter went to, we were convinced that had she graduated from there, she would have graduated with a 7th grade education.
Oy.
Because most of it's minorities. And, you know, they're the farm workers' children, and they're starting later.
Right.
But that still shocks me that doesn't mean that you're not taught and brought up to...
Yeah, right. That's what the school is supposed to do.
Well, they're just passing them.
Right.
So I saw that what she was learning at that school compared to what she had learned the year before at the other school was, behind it.
Oh, jeez.
So now she's been accepted into a charter school, which is challenging for her, and, you know, we're watching it, so that's much better. But it brought me back to that, we're screwed. And it reinforced my idea that if you continue living the way, quote-unquote, society wants you to live, you're going to have a boring, short life. Because the day you die, if you're lucky enough to have an actual thought about it, you're going to go, I didn't do anything.
Right, what was that
you
about?
You know what I mean? I didn't do a damn thing.
Right.
I busted my ass, and now this is it.
Yeah. I think that's true for a lot of people before they die.
Yeah, if you have the chance to take that thought. See, I don't know if I'll be able to think that. I don't know, because, I mean, really, I think everybody should do everything they can to go out and do the craziest idea they've ever had. Go do it. I don't care what it is. Just to do it. You know, if it's something that's been crawling at your soul, then you need to do it. To me, that's healthy. Because now I know now that, yeah, you can die at any given moment.
Yeah.
So I stopped curbing my tongue. And people think I use it as convenience, which, no, I was pretty sharp-tongued before. but now I do it with even less remorse than I had before. I don't see the reason to care. I mean, I care about people, obviously. I mean,
yeah,
I sit on the board of tons of charities and do my thing, but, I mean, at the end of the day, I'm going to do everything I can to do it my way, and if not, I'd care less. That's pretty much how I'm approaching life now. You know, at the same token, you have to give up things to live that way. You have to give up thinking that, okay, well, all right, how are we getting groceries next week?
Mm-hmm.
I decided to tell that last band to go to hell. It's like Microsoft back with their whole, basically Microsoft, in my opinion, and it's true, it's fact. I mean, put up past all the BS, they're trying to punish them for being the best.
Right. And anyway, it didn't work.
No. You know, and it's not like you were going to affect Bill Gates at that point.
Yeah,
anyways,
why did he care?
Because right now, you know what? We need Bill Gates right now. So don't piss him off and send him somewhere else. I mean, the Microsoft dollar is the only one that's still holding its value.
That's right.
And they actually have Microsoft dollars. If you work for Microsoft, there's Microsoft money.
Really?
Oh, yeah. They have Microsoft stores. They have, all through campus and where the main offices are, there's Microsoft money. And you can go online and you buy Microsoft money or transfer your money into Microsoft money.
And then what? You can buy anything that you can
buy? Services or anything else, but their employees do it all the time.
Wow.
And you know what doesn't change? The value of a Microsoft dollar.
Wow.
It's kind of interesting, but...
Well,
you know,
it sure is. It's like a business...
it's a little world.
I was
it's
just going to say, like,
kind of like people thought Disney
like
used to be.
Right, you know what I mean?
But Disney didn't pull it off.
No.
You know, Disney unfortunately went, you know, to the most dangerous thing in the world and became very religious. You know, so...
Yeah.
You know, which they're not, you know, that obviously hurt them. Hey, the worst thing in the world is organized religion. You got a book full of stories and now you're going to base your whole life and give your money for it? You're an idiot. You know, give your money to me. Your pastor doesn't need another BMW. You know what I mean?
Yes, right.
So, a load of crap that is. But, it's, we're, as a society, trying to punish everybody. And so, I think getting into music, we just came way back to it.
Yeah.
Producing music is, it's a great escape. It's a great escape.
It's a beautiful place.
If you can look at music as layers or waves or silk sheets,
mm-hmm.
you can decide with music whether they're going to be starchy and scratchy. Is it going to be soft?
Yeah.
Are they going to be at still? Or are they going to be in a high wind? I mean, you can change all the textures of music. And it's the only thing that you can actually change. You know, you can look at it with textures or colors, however you want to look at it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the only thing you can constantly change and manipulate into your mood. And it's how people's playlists are. And they don't think about it that way. But your playlist is exactly how you are in life. You can judge a person based upon what they're listening to right when they're listening to it.
Do you want to give an example?
Okay, you've got a factory worker.
Mm-hmm.
While he's at work, it's a constant, steady, classic rock, and it's going.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And all of a sudden, 5 o'clock hits, and the music gets a little heavier. You know what I mean? A little harder rock.
Wow.
And then by the end of the night, it's a slow ballad, and he's pretty buzzed and ready to go to bed. You know what I mean? And it's the same thing when you're driving. You check your mood. If you're on a country drive, I mean, my country drives, my favorite is Vivaldi's Four Seasons. You know, because it's a soothing and it fits the drive. I use music more cinematically to life, I guess.
Yes, you do.
than
yes,
some
you
people,
do.
But
you
most people do
it's
it.
It's a soundtrack for you.
Well, it is. And you know what? This is how nuts I am going in my head. I have caught music reacting to my drives a certain way to where I will remember where in that song and what song it was at that point, and next time I come through there,
mm-hmm.
Like there's a point, Pink Floyd, great instrumental, you know what I mean, stuff that they do. I was coming down a mountain hill, and it comes to this point where in the song the toms are quietly building and
mm-hmm.
keys are starting to go, right as I come around the corner, you catch this just awesome view of the Columbia River, and there's Mount Adams with snow and the sun. And right then, right as I came around the corner, is when all of a sudden, here's the crescendo. The music hits, and we're in full swing, and I was like, see, now that...
Yeah, it's perfect.
There it is. You know what I mean?
It's a movie.
Yeah, and I do it consciously, but what I'm referring to in this sense is that people do it all the time unconsciously. And they don't realize that what they're listening to, you know, this isn't, they got the radio on, and it's the Eagles, and they want Metallica, because their mood is hard and charging, and Metallica's like a freight train ripping down a highway, you know what I mean, musically. So, and they don't catch themselves, and I love to sit back in my car sometimes with it off, and just listen to what these people have cranked, and sit there and determine going,
you mean what, in the cars around?
Yeah. And you can determine who's pissed off, who's going through what, because they don't realize that music, everything, there's so many genres. There's not. There's happy, sad, pissed off, and lover's lament.
Oh my God.
Those are the only four genres. Well, think about it. You know, that's all there is. You can call it classical, rock, jazz, whatever you want to call it. But it doesn't matter. Those are really the only four genres of music. Because that's all people are trying to achieve with it. You know what I mean?
That's what it reflects.
Right, and that's what people don't realize about music.
Right.
They don't. They think they're just buying a CD to listen to it. They're not. They're actually augmenting their mind and augmenting how they're going to approach the time while they're listening to it. Because that's the mood they're in. And they don't think about it that way. When you put something in that you want to hear, you got to stop yourself and ask, why do I want to hear this?
I will do that.
It's going to be a direct reflect of the mood you're in.
You know,
or you're going to be trying to alter your mood and force yourself into that.
I think
that's the worst thing to do.
Because?
Because you now have put too much on that music. Instead of the simplistic enjoyment of it, you're now expecting this simple piece of music to change your life.
Kind of what people do with their spouses.
It's not going to happen.
No, it's not going to happen with your spouse either.
Right, yeah. Yeah, well, right up there with religion is marriage. No. But no, that's what people don't get again. They put too much on music.
Yeah.
You know, and expect too much from it.
Again, like spouses. And maybe even religion.
Definitely religion.
Yeah.
I don't know what people expect. I mean, if it makes their day better or tries to make them a better person, that's great. But, I mean, the only way you can look at religion is that it's responsible for more death than anything else. And there's nothing also more contradictive than religion in the total sense of the word. Doesn't matter which...
You mean it contradicts itself or they contradict themselves?
Well, both. When you think about it, both. I mean, think about it. How can there be a Latter-day Saint? How's that even possible? Right?
Yeah.
And the New Testament to the Old Testament. Well, wait a second. They came back and wrote another one? Oh, no, no, no. Well, we changed this one to fit the times. Now, if you look back into some of the theories of religion, manipulation, we go back to it. You need people to follow you into, right?
Right.
Hitler proved this. Mm-hmm. I mean, Hitler, he's a genius, you know, to some sense. He got manipulation. And it's, you know, control natural resources. And control what's fed intellectually. He had it down to a science, which when you think about that, you know what? It's the Bible. It has its scapegoats, it has its natural resources, and boy does it have its fear-based. You know what I mean? And if anything's going to make you feel better about something telling you, if you do this, you're going to hell, if you do that, you're going to hell, and the first commandment is thou shalt not kill, but every war, there's never been a secular war, they're all based on religion. So they immediately contradict themselves right there. You don't believe in the same thing I do, I'm going to kill you. We can go back as far as man's existed to find that to be the truth. So, I mean, I don't understand why our churches and religions, not just exempt from taxes, apparently jail time and corporate fraud. God, I can go on for a long time here.
Well,
yeah, that's another one that really irritates. Religion actually starts, I can feel myself now. The smartest thing for me is the closest would be the Indians. Sun God, the fire God, the water God. These are things that you can't explain why they're here. But you know without them, you're going to die.
Yeah.
That's a God. You know, because I've come to the conclusion, the more time you spend trying to figure this out is the more time you've wasted. You're not going to figure out on this earth why you're on this earth.
Yeah,
so
well, you
don't even spend a second trying to figure it out. Just go enjoy it. Tom Dowd, you know, I really like what you're trying to do. I'm just not sure about how you're trying to do it. And it's been a pressure working with you, and the pleasure was all yours. And if you need me, I'll call you.
You know? Did he say that?
Yeah. I always thought that was great. You know, but
it's like get to Chicago or by bus.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. You know, but uh-huh. I guess everybody's a little more sugar, but it's it comes back to music for me is music is everything. It's like producing. You get these bands that, in my opinion, end up sounding so commercial because the producer came in and just made it the same right. as this one.
Right.
Same as that. I call them cookie cutter albums.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's the same cookie cutter.
Right.
You know, music has a song has a life of its own. And this is where bands like the Allman Brothers Band, the Grateful Dead, they got it right. Even Bach got it right. Vivaldi got it right. All those guys. A song lives as long as it lives and will die appropriately. A song is not 3 minutes, 30 seconds, as the record companies would like to think.
Yeah, right.
It's not the way it works. A song, once it gets going, will invoke the musicians.
Right. It has a life.
Yes.
Right.
And it will die in its given time. So if that song's 40 minutes long, then...
That's what it is.
That song's 40 minutes long.
Right.
And that song should never be played the same way again or tried to.
Right.
It should be the rudimentary bits of that song, but again, it will take on its own...
Right. It'll be alive.
Right. And it'll become what it does until it dies.
Yeah.
To me, that's music.
Oh, God, Christopher. I think that's a good place to stop. I do.
Okay.
I do. Thank you.
Yep. Is that what you wanted? Insight to my madness?
Yeah, well, I just wanted you.
And that's a real music man. A man who was captured really, really early by music itself. Not one genre of music, not some idea about music, but the basic experience of listening to music and what it means and how to honor it, and has held on to that attachment all of his life. And as you heard, is courageously attempting to live an authentic life in a world which works against authenticity. So thank you, Christopher, for that glimpse into your madness, for your honesty and your courage. So I've just got enough time to thank Josh Hackney yet again. Josh, who's on his way over here to help me take something out of YouTube so we can put it in a show, which I hope you will hear next week. Josh, who can do anything with the internet, with recording, with sound. And as always, I hope that you heard something that you can use in this show, something that entertained you or piqued your interest or even maybe annoyed you, but something that brings you back, because I will be here next week, and as always, I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boy. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a bang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle.